This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. In the neighborhood of Vermont Knolls in South Los Angeles, on a residential street, you'll find a batch of brand new homes. Eight small brown stucco bungalows on one lot.
It's an earth tone that we really like that I think technically is called like cafe or something like that.
In May, these bungalows are set to become home to people who previously had no shelter at all. This eight-unit homeless housing project is one drop in the bucket. At least 41,000 people live on the city streets or in its shelters. But here's why this project is noteworthy. It was built for less than half the cost of a typical permanent supportive housing project and in a fraction of the time. John Perfitt is the head of the nonprofit developer behind this bungalow court, Restore Neighborhoods LA, or RNLA.
I just have always felt that there's a better way to do things. I think there's a lot of room for change, perhaps disruption, from the way that we've traditionally approached and the paradigms we've used for financing things and building things.
So how did his company do it? And could it be done again on a larger scale? KCRW's reporter Anna Scott joins me right now. She covers housing and homelessness for us. Hey, Anna.
Hey, Steve.
So what are the numbers on this project? How much cheaper, how much faster was it than a typical homeless housing development?
Well, a typical permanent supportive housing project in LA, which means apartments for low-income, previously homeless tenants with services attached, like case management, can take years of planning just to break ground and easily costs more than $500,000, even $600,000 per unit. This project cost about $225,000 per unit.
Wow, that's some big savings. But I have to ask this question. Why is most affordable housing so expensive?
Yeah, it's a good question, and one that you need to understand, actually, to understand how RNLA did it for less. So once upon a time, like back in the 1930s, the 1940s, the federal government put a lot of money into building public housing. You may know this. Now, most affordable housing gets built by developers. But building anything in LA is really expensive. Real estate is really, really expensive. And there's this extra dilemma when you're doing affordable housing, which is it's just not inherently profitable to build low-cost housing for the people who need it the most.
Right, profitable. So these developers aren't going to make back their money by charging super high rent in the end in these buildings, right? But they're also not working for free.
Yeah. So the way that they make these projects pencil out is actually key to why most affordable housing projects cost so much and take so long.
We call it the lasagna of financing, right? You know, there can be many layers to the lasagna, right?
That's Tara Borowskis. She's the executive director of a traditional nonprofit affordable housing developer called Community Corp of Santa Monica. And the lasagna that she's talking about involves developers stacking layer upon layer upon layer of all of these different types of money, government loans and grants, private bank loans. One apartment building could have 5 to 10 different funding sources. And this is the product of a whole financial system that's been built over the last few decades around making this unprofitable thing solvent.
Typically, projects in LA will have city money, county money, state money, private money, maybe acquisition funding, and none of them align in terms of timing or even priorities.
None of them align. In other words, she has to go around getting money, I guess, from all these different pots, and they all have different deadlines and different amounts of paperwork and things like that.
Exactly. And stacking it all up just right can take years. And you often have to pay lots of fees and hire lots of people to help you through this.
All right, got it. So that explains a lot about why affordable housing is generally expensive and slow. So what is John Perfitt over at this place, RNLA, doing in Vermont Knolls in South LA?
He really simplified the funding for this project. The whole thing costs about $1.6 million, and he got that from just a few sources. And there are two that are important to talk about. So the biggest chunk of money for this bungalow court comes not from any government loans or programs, but from a private loan from something called Genesis LA. This is a community loan fund, kind of like a bank, but with a social impact mission to invest in low-income or underserved communities. And they make loans that a lot of traditional banks wouldn't necessarily make. So from Genesis LA, he got about $920,000.
All right. So if the whole project that John Perfitt is putting together here costs $1.6 million, that's That's most of the money right there.
Yeah, and that one loan helped to build the bungalows, and it stays in the property like a mortgage that gets paid off over time, which doesn't sound at all novel in the normal world, but it is in the world of affordable housing.
I can see, Anna, how that would save time and maybe some money, too, in terms of not having to, you know, navigate lots of government rules. But also, if they're getting what's basically a bank loan, which is what this is, they have to pay it back, right? They have to pay it back with interest. How are they going to do that?
So that gets to the second super important part of the equation here, which is rental vouchers. So you know how Section 8 vouchers usually work? If you have one, wherever you go to rent an apartment, you'll only pay a third of your income towards your rent, and the government will pay your landlord the rest. Well, in this case, through LA County, the developer got rental vouchers that are attached to the apartments instead of the tenants. So for the people moving in, it works the same way. They'll pay a third of their income, whatever that is. And for the developers, they can count on a certain amount of rental income each month that's more or less market rate, even as the tenants come and go. So they were able to figure out upfront how much they could afford to borrow.
All right. So they're building the homes with private money, getting most of the rent money that they need from the government. Why doesn't everyone do things that way to make it quicker and less costly?
Yeah, well, not everyone can afford to. There are a lot of things that came together with this project that are unique. First of all, those rental vouchers aren't just readily available to anyone who wants them. It's competitive for developers to get them. This is also a small project. It's just 8 units. It costs less than $2 million in total. If you're building a 100-unit apartment building, even 50 units for people with little to no income in Los Angeles, and it's going to cost you tens of millions of dollars to build, most of the time you are going to need help from the government all along the way to make it work. Even though, ironically, that may make your total costs go up because you're taking longer to go through that process. And it can kind of snowball. One person I spoke to about this is Tom DeSimone. He's the CEO of Genesis LA, the lender that's providing most of RNLA's funding.
The challenge is that once you touch one source of government funding, it usually triggers a whole array of new requirements that adds to cost and time. And so it sort of results in an all or nothing. It's like, try to avoid government money at all, or just throw in the towel and finance the whole thing with government money.
And most big affordable housing developers do throw in that towel because at this point, as cumbersome as it is, relying on government money all the way through is still the tried and true way of making these projects work financially.
All right. So then is there a larger takeaway from what RNLA is doing? I mean, could it be replicated around the city, or is it just, you know, I mean, this guy is lucky and this project is a go and people are going to be helped, but this is a one-time thing.
Well, first of all, RNLA does have some other projects, not just this one. They are still small, though, about 120 units in the pipeline total. There are also other developers in LA that are doing some version of this same kind of business model, including at least one larger one, though still not on a huge scale. And at the same time, local and federal government officials are looking for ways to get more housing faster and cheaper, especially with LA's homelessness crisis being as enormous as it is, with four people dying unhoused in the county every day. This is an urgent issue, clearly. So, for example, right now the city is studying other countries' social housing policies to see if that's something that could be done in Los Angeles. And President Joe Biden has proposed vastly expanding the Section 8 voucher program so that everyone who needs one can get one. That would be a really big change. It would have to go through Congress for that to happen. But if it did, it would immediately help a lot more people find affordable housing.
Those are, of course, big ifs going forward. But thanks for keeping tabs on it. KCRW's Anna Scott, who covers housing and homelessness for us. Anna, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Here's a question for you. What do an Oscar de la Renta gown and the Antelope Valley train line have in common? Well, they're both going to be cruising through Union Station in Los Angeles next month. It is runway meets railway. Producers of the 93rd Academy Awards say this year's event, scheduled for April 25th, will be held at two locations, at the Dolby Theater, where it usually is in Hollywood, but also at downtown LA's main transit hub. Now, the plan could cause a headache for commuters, as well as those experiencing homelessness who live on the streets nearby. That's a stark backdrop to Hollywood's opulence. Here to talk about it is Scott Feinberg, awards columnist with The Hollywood Reporter. Hey, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You bet. Union Station seems like a pretty surprising location for the Oscars. I mean, they're usually held at a big fancy theater. I know the performances will take place at the Dolby, but like the actual ceremony, you know, the presenters and the, you know, the winners and the nominees and things like that, that's going to be at Union Station, right?
That's what it seems like. You know, the Academy, I think, is still figuring this out and plans to brief the studios and talent and everyone this week, but it does seem like they were looking for a large enough venue where they could spread out the handful of people who are going to be there. Normally it's thousands of people at the Oscars. This year it's only going to be nominees, their guests, and presenters. Very, very intimate, but they still want to make sure everybody's very socially distanced. And so, yes, the main ceremony, it seems, in the same way that the Grammys was kind of outdoors and intimate just a few weeks ago, will be at Union Station. And then the performance elements will be at the Dolby, where the main ceremony usually is, so that they have the lighting and sound equipment that they need to do that at a high production value. But again, it's all fluid and things could change between now and just over a month from now.
They needed another venue to be able to do, to be able to separate these things, right?
It seems that way, yeah.
Has this ever happened before? I'm you know, the Oscars obviously have taken place in many different places. You know, Shrine Auditorium took place at the Biltmore for a little while, you know, other places as well. Santa Monica. I think it was held in Santa Monica for a time.
Exactly. And, you know, there are variations of precedent for this. I mean, in the 50s, they had bi-coastal Oscar ceremonies for several years. People were, it was the early days of TV. They thought it would be cool to have, you know, simulcast from New York and LA. So there was that for a few years. In the early days, the Oscars was a dinner dancing banquet. There wasn't this sort of sitting in rows and just waiting to hear people's names called. So, you know, it's a tough position they're in. And they also, I think part of the reason they're adamant about not having people zoom in for this and doing it in person and trying to make it visually interesting is that just the recent other award ceremonies, particularly the Golden Globes, have been total technical disasters with record low ratings. And while I think the Academy realizes that no matter what they do, they're probably going to have record low ratings this year just because not many people have seen the movies relative to a normal year, I do think they're trying everything they can to mitigate against that.
I guess where my head is kind of exploding here is, you know, this dichotomy, right? I mean, because Union Station is a commuter station, and it can be busy, certainly during some parts of the day. I don't know about Sunday. Sunday's usually a pretty quiet day, I would imagine. But you're still going to have people around there. And I wonder how this is, I mean, is there going to be a runway, like, around the rail line? I mean, how is that going to work?
I think it's all, again, still very fluid, but, you know, keep in mind that wherever you do the Oscars, there's generally a pretty big footprint that disrupts the area. I mean, in a normal year, it's at the Dolby Theater, which is part of the Hollywood and Highland Center, which by contractual obligation, all of those stores within that complex agree that for that week each year they have to shut down. You then gate off much of Hollywood. You know, it is a giant event that brings in a lot of money to the city. And I think that for that reason, there is some understanding about the inconvenience that comes with doing it. But sure, I mean, no matter where they do it, though, I think they were gonna run into some aggrieved people. But I think that, again, because it is relatively small this year compared to other years, I think they can probably get in and out a lot quicker than they normally do.
You mentioned the Oscars, they're being, you know, pretty cagey. I mean, I wonder,
yep.
The producers did send out a pretty comical letter to the nominees, especially as it pertains to dress code.
Yeah, they don't want people showing up in jeans.
Yeah, I mean, talk about what people are going to be dressed like.
I mean, we'll see. I think it's perhaps not going to be as formal as it sometimes is at the Oscars, but they also are saying, you know, that does not mean you can show up in jeans. My guess is that most people will still dress to the nines because, again, this is the Mount Everest of award shows. They know they're going to be heavily photographed and seen by more people than any other award show would expose them to. So I'm guessing that no matter what guidance they get here, they're gonna play it up. But it is a unusual situation where, you know, I don't know how much of a red carpet there's going to be because they're not planning to have media present at the moment. I'm a member of the Los Angeles Press Club and a member of the Hollywood Reporter, and we're working on them to try to, you know, this is a major historic event in its own way, and it's sort of like if a tree falls in a forest and no one's there, does it make a sound? Well, if the only people that are there are ABC's cameras during the ceremony, why should people go crazy with fashion and all of that?
They went without a host last year, and by the way, last year the Oscars took place before the pandemic really took hold, right?
That's right.
So this is the first ceremony in the COVID era, as it were. Will they go hostless again?
You know, it's again, they play their cards very close to the vest. I have heard in years past where there was even some discussion with particularly Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis that they were going to, you know, it was going to appear that there was no host, and then they were going to be recruited out of the audience as if they had not planned for this. And then they were going to host the show acting bewildered, but actually having coordinated it. Obviously, this year there has been no announcement of a host, and yet it's very hard to imagine how they could do it without one. You know, the way they've gone about it in the last few years when they've had no host was to basically just have each presenter serve as a mini host. But in a year in which there's going to have to be some context given, do you bring out somebody basically to just essentially host the opening monologue and then disappear if they don't want to host the whole thing? You know, it's, again, they're not giving out a ton of information, and it's unclear if that's because they themselves don't have their act together yet, or they just want to kind of have some element of surprise to hopefully goose the ratings a little bit.
We can't leave you, Scott, without asking the question on who you're betting on. I mean, what films do you think will win big this year?
Well, you know, we again are still a month plus away from the show, but at the moment, it is clearly Nomadland's to lose for Best Picture. That has won everything. It is the most critically acclaimed of the Best Picture nominees, and so that's looking very strong for director, and its director, Chinese filmmaker Chloe Zhao, would become potentially the second female, only the second female director to win that prize for Best Director. The acting awards are a little bit more up in the air, aside from Best Actor, which looks pretty good for the late Chadwick Boseman, who would be posthumously recognized for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. But beyond that, you know, it's there's still kind of a lot to unfold for the other categories.
Another soul we lost just in the past year. Just, wow.
Exactly.
Scott Feinberg, awards columnist with The Hollywood Reporter. Scott, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. LA isn't the only city in California with a Chinatown. San Francisco has one, of course. So does Sacramento, and so do San Diego and San Jose. But you might not know that Santa Ana used to have one many years ago. Time for a little history lesson across the Orange County line. In his LA Times column last week, Gustavo Arellano wrote about Santa Ana's Chinatown and what happened to it. He's here with us now to talk about it. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So tell us about it. What was Chinatown in Orange County like?
Well, Santana's Chinatown was on what's now currently Bush, 3rd, and Main Street. So at its height around, we're talking about way back in the day, 1880s, 1890s, had about 200 people at a time, mind you, when the American government had banned all migration of Chinese into the United States, when white citizens were murdering, flat-out lynching Chinese all across the West, and at a time where they were not allowed to be citizens or own any property, but nevertheless, they created a vibrant neighborhood there.
And the city of Santa Ana wasn't really supportive, right, of China. I mean, just like everybody else, the city of Santa Ana was like, well, you know, what's going on here? They did their best to get rid of it, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The city of Santana officials just did everything possible to, you know, I didn't mention this in my column, but the property owner there in that area was an older white woman who the press, of course, described as eccentric. And she said, look, I could rent to whoever I want, the city, no matter what sort of fines you're throwing on me. These people, they have every right to live there because they're paying the rent. As long as they pay the rent, I have no problem with them. But the city tried and tried again to kick out, you know, to boot out this Chinatown, and then finally it became enough for them.
It became enough, and then what happened?
So in 1906, the city health officials all of a sudden claimed that a man in Chinatown had leprosy. And of course, leprosy, the grand scourge of millennia, and you know, of millennia going back to, you know, going all the way to the Bible. So immediately because of that, they get all the residents of Chinatown. By then, there's only about 15 people who live in Chinatown because a lot of those men, they just didn't want to deal with the racism anymore. They get quarantined off to a small lot right, you know, just south of the Chinatown. Nowadays, it's a Rite Aid. And then they go to the city council and say, hey, guys, by the way, Chinatown, we need to get rid of it. Let's burn it. So the Santa Ana Fire Department, they go, they douse everything in coal. Now, the day that Chinatown burned was drizzly, so the fire, you know, wasn't going off. And then finally it did. Earlier in the day, there were crowds waiting for it. It dissipated as they thought it wasn't going to happen. By the time the flames went up at night in Chinatown, this is according to both press and historical accounts, over 1,000 people went on to cheer.
Good Lord. So it's heartbreaking. Again, it's shocking.
County.
Shocking, but not surprising. What happened to the guy who contracted leprosy or
so
was assumed to have?
I did a story about him originally in 2014 for the former publication that I wrote. And so by reading the press accounts, there was actually debate whether he had leprosy or not. What is not debatable, though, is that they did not give him medication to combat his leprosy, and he passed away. He passed away, and he was complaining that he was not getting any food. I personally think that health officials just let the man starve, because years later, there was a similar case with a Japanese resident who was not a citizen. He had leprosy, and the County of Orange and the city, they did everything possible to be able to save him, and they did. I mean, what it boiled down to was that the city did not want Chinatown there. They did not want any Chinese men or women there, and so they would do anything possible to get rid of them, and they did.
What was the reaction like, Gustavo? And did the news media cover it? I mean, there was the LA Times back then. The Orange County Register was brand new. Did anybody cover this?
Oh, of course. It was a big whoop-de-doo. You know, my paper, you know, the LA Times, we said, quote, it was as picturesque an event as could be imagined, because this is at a time. I mean, we as much racism as there is right now, we can't even comprehend what was going on.
Wait. But the LA Times said picturesque, as in, wow, look at this beautiful sight of a part of town burning down.
Of course, and an eyewitness said it was like a big picnic on a 4th of July. The Chinese government, they did send a representative down to try to advocate on behalf of the Chinese residents to at least get some money for all their material. All their entire lives were burned down along with their lodgings. But the city of Santa Ana effectively told the Chinese government and the Chinese residents there to go pound sand.
There's a long history, obviously, of anti-Asian hate. I should say a lot of hate against any other in America for so many years, particularly here in California. And I think that's the point, obviously, that you're trying to make in this column. I mean, Atlanta notwithstanding, COVID notwithstanding, and what the prior administration, President Trump and his followers, have been treating Asian Americans because of COVID. I mean, what kind of lessons do we learn from this?
to not forget, and especially with California, as I always like to tell people, California to its core is so racist that we were even racist against white American citizens, the so-called Okies, the poor folks from Oklahoma and Arkansas who fled during the Dust Bowl era and the Great Depression. And the LA Sheriff's Department, or I believe it was PD, they set up patrols in Barstow to make sure that they didn't try to come into California. That's how racist we are. But I would argue that with anti-Asian racism, and this is not the racism Olympics, but there's a perniciousness to anti-Asian racism. And the saddest part about it, in my opinion, is that how little of it's actually known. So many incidents, so much hate. What's happening now with advocates trying to bring back these lessons from the dead, may it actually permeate and, percolate through our minds so we do not forget ever again.
Gustavo Arellano, LA Times columnist, joins us, of course, every week for KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, Reefer Madness makes it into the desert. How cannabis tourism could be a lot for some to inhale, but also a boon to the economy. Join us online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Never miss another show. Subscribe to the podcast. Let us know how you're doing and how we're doing. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Thanks for your ears and support this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great night.